bewildered. He stalked toward the center of the iconostasis, where a second Christ sat enthroned, surrounded by apostles. The moonlight turned his gold hair to gray silver, and his shadow crawled black across the floor. "Demons can be exorcised, Anna Ivanovna," he said, not taking his eyes from the icon.
Exorcised? She squeaked.
"Naturally."
"How?"
She felt as though she were thinking through mud. All her life she had borne her curse, that it might just go away. Her mind wouldn't compass the notion. "Rites of the church and much prayer." There was a small silence. "Oh," Anna breathed. "Oh, please, make it go away. Make them go away." He might have smiled, but she couldn't be sure in the moonlight. "I will pray and think on it. Go back and go to sleep, Anna Ivanovna." She stared at him with big, stunned eyes, then whirled and blundered toward the door, feet clumsy on the bare wood. Father Constantine prostrated himself before the iconostasis. He did not sleep at all the rest of the night. The next day was Sunday. In the green-gray dawn, Constantine returned to his own room. Heavy-eyed, he flung cold water over his head and washed his hands. Soon he must give service. He was weary but calm. During the long hours of his vigil, God had given him the answer. He knew what evil lay upon this land. It was in the sun symbols on the nurse's apron, in that stupid woman's terror, in the fey, feral eyes of Pyotr's elder daughter. The place was infested with demons, the certi of the old religion. These foolish, wild people worshipped God by day and the old gods in secret. They tried to walk both paths at once and made themselves base in the sight of the Father. No wonder evil had come to work its mischief. Excitement rolled through his veins. He'd thought to molder here in the back of beyond. But here was battle indeed, a battle for mastery of the souls of men and women, with evil on one side and him as God's messenger on the other. The people were gathering. He could almost feel their eager curiosity. It was not yet like Moscow, where people snatched hungrily at his words and loved him with their frightened eyes. Not yet, but it would be. Vasya twitched a shoulder and wished she could take off her headdress. Because they were in church, Dunya had added a veil to the heavy contrivance of cloth and wood and semi-precious stones. It itched, but she was nothing compared to Anna, who was dressed as though for a feast day, a jeweled cross round her neck and rings on each finger. Dunya had taken one look at her mistress and muttered under her breath about piety and gold hair. Even Pyotr raised an eyebrow at his wife, but he held his peace. Vasya followed her brothers into church, scratching her scalp. Women stood on the left of the nave before the Virgin, while men stood on the right, in front of the Christ. Vasya had always wished she could stand next to Alyosha so they could poke and fidget during the service. Irina was so small and sweet that poking was not rewarding, and anyway, Anna always saw. Vasya locked her fingers behind her back. The doors at the center of the iconostasis opened, and the priest came out. The murmurs of the assembled village drifted into silence, punctuated by a girl's giggle. The church was small, and Father Constantine seemed to fill it. His golden hair drew the eye as even Anna's jewels could not. His blue gaze pierced the throng like knives, one at a time. He did not speak at once. A breathless hush spread like sound among the people, so that Vasya found herself straining to hear their soft, eager breathing. "Blessed is the kingdom," said Constantine at last, his voice washing over them, "of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, now and ever and unto ages of ages." He didn't sound like Father Semyon, thought Vasya, though the words of the liturgy were the same. His voice was like thunder, yet he placed each syllable like Dunya setting stitches. Under his touch, the words came alive. His voice was deep as rivers in spring. He spoke to them of life and death, of God and of sin. He spoke of things they did not know, of devils and torments and temptation. He called it up before their eyes so that they saw themselves submitting to the judgment of God and saw themselves damned and flung down. As he chanted, Constantine pulled the crowd to him until they echoed his words in a daze of fascinated terror. He drove them on and on with the supple lash of his voice until their answering voices broke and they listened like children frightened during a thunderstorm. Just as they were on the verge of panic or rapture, his voice gentled. Have mercy on us and save us, for he is good and the lover of mankind. A heavy silence fell. In the stillness, Constantine raised his right hand and blessed the crowd. They trickled out of the church like sleepwalkers, clutching one another. Anna had a look of exalted terror that Vasya couldn't understand. The others looked dazed, even exhausted, the trailing ends of fearful rapture in their eyes.
Yoshka!
Vasya called, darting over to her brother. But when he turned to her, he was pale like the others, and his gaze seemed to meet hers from a long way away. She slapped him, frightened to see his eyes blank. Abruptly, Alyosha came back to himself and gave her a shove that should have put her in the dust, but she was quick as a squirrel and wearing a new gown. So she writhed backward and kept her feet, and then the two were glaring at each other, chests heaving and fists clenched. They both recovered their senses at the same time. They laughed, and Alyosha said, Is it true then, Vasya? Demons among us and torments in store if we do not cast them out? But the Cherti, is he talking about the Cherti? The women have always left bread for the domovoy. What care has God for that?
Stories or no, why should we cast out the household spirits on the word of some old priest from Moscow? Snapped Vasya. We have always left them bread and salt and water, and God was not angry.
We have not starved, said Alyosha hesitantly. And there have been no fires or sickness. But perhaps God is waiting for us to die so that our punishment might never end.
For heaven's sake, Lyoshka, Vasya began.
But she was interrupted by Dunya calling. Anna had decreed a meal of special magnificence, and Vasya must roll dumplings and stir the soup. They dined outside on eggs and kasha and summer greens, bread and cheese and honey. The usual cheerful muddle was subdued. The young peasant women stood in knots and whispered. Constantine, chewing meditatively, wore a glow of satisfaction. Pyotr, frowning, swung his head here and there like the bull that scents danger, but has not yet seen the wolves in the grass.
Father understands wild beasts and raiders, thought Vasya, but sin and damnation cannot be fought.
The others gazed at the priest with terror and a hungry admiration. Anna Ivanovna glowed with a kind of hesitant joy. Their fervor seemed to lift Constantine and carry him like a galloping horse. Vasya did not know it, but in the silence of the nave after all the people had gone, the priest had thrown that feeling into his exorcism, thrown it all, until even a man without the sight would swear he could hear devils crying out and running for their lives, out of Pyotr's walls and far away. That summer, Constantine went among the people and listened to their woes. He blessed the dying and he blessed the newborn. He listened when spoken to. And when his deep voice rang out, the people fell silent to hear him. Repent, he told them, lest you burn. The fire is very near. It is waiting for you and for your children, each time you lie down to sleep. Give your fruits to God and God alone. It is your only salvation. The people murmured together, and the murmurs grew more and more fearful. Constantine ate at Pyotr's table every night. His voice set their honey wine rippling and rattled their wooden spoons.
Irina took to putting her spoon against her cup, giggling to hear them click together. Vasya abetted her in this. The child's gaiety was a relief. Talk of damnation did not frighten Irina. She was too young. But Vasya was frightened. Not of the priest, and not of devils, nor of pits of fire. She had seen their devils. She saw them every day. Some were wicked, and some were kind, and some were mischievous. All were as human in their way as the folk they guarded. No, Vasya was frightened of her own people. They did not joke on the way to church anymore. They listened to Father Constantine in heavy, hungry silence. And even when they were not in church, the people made excuses to visit his room. Constantine had begged beeswax from Pyotr, which he would melt and mix with his pigments. When the daylight shone into his cell, he would take up brushes and open files of crushed powders, and then he would paint. St. Peter took form under his brush. The saint's beard was curly, his robe yellow and umber, his strange, long-fingered hand raised in benediction. Lesnaya Zemlya could talk of nothing else. One Sunday, desperate, Vasya smuggled a handful of crickets into the church and dropped them among the worshippers. Their chirping made an amusing counterpoint to Father Constantine's deep voice, but no one laughed. They cringed and whispered of evil omens. Anna Ivanovna had not seen, but she did suspect who was behind it. After the service, she called Vasya to her. Vasya came unwillingly to her stepmother's chamber. A length of willow lay ready in Anna's hand. The priest sat by the open window, grinding a scrap of blue stone to powder. He did not seem to listen while Anna questioned her stepdaughter, but Vasya knew the questions were for the priest's benefit, to show her stepmother righteous and mistress in her own house. The questioning went on and on. "I would do it again," snapped Vasya at last, exasperated beyond caution. "Did not God make all creatures? Why should we alone be allowed to raise our voices in praise? Crickets worship with songs as much as we." Constantine's blue glance flicked toward her, though she could not read his expression. "Insolence!" shrieked Anna. "Sacrilege!" Vasya, chin high, kept silence even as her stepmother's willow switch whistled down. Constantine watched, grave and inscrutable. Vasya met his eyes and refused to look away. Anna saw the girl and the priest, their steady mutual regard, and her furious face turned redder than ever. She put all the strength of her arm into the sharp willow. Vasya stood still for it, biting her lip bloody. But the tears welled, despite her best efforts, and hurried down her cheeks. Behind Anna, Constantine watched, wordless. Vasya cried out once toward the end, as much in humiliation as in pain. But then it was over. Alyosha, white-lipped, had gone to find their father. Pyotr saw the blood and his daughter's white face and seized Anna's arm. Vasya said no word to her father or to anyone else. She stumbled away at once, though her brother tried to call her back, and hid in the wood like a wounded thing. If she wept, only the Rusalka heard. "That will teach her the price of sin," said Anna proudly when Pyotr reproved her for brutality. "Better she learn now than burn later, Pyotr Vladimirovich." Constantine said nothing. What he thought, he did not say. After her cuts healed, Vasya walked more softly and held her tongue more readily. She spent more time with the horses and concocted wild plans to dress as a boy and go to join Sasha in his monastery or send a secret messenger to Olga. Alyosha, though he did not tell her, began to mark her comings and goings so that she was never alone with her stepmother. All this while, Constantine condemned the people's offerings, bread or honey wine, that they made to their hearth spirits. "Give it to God," he said. "Forget your demons lest you burn." The people listened. Even Dunya was half convinced, she muttered to herself, shook her old head, and picked the sun symbols from aprons and kerchiefs. Vasya did not see it. She hid in the wood or in the stable. But the domovoy regretted her absence more than anyone else, because for him now there was nothing but crumbs.
Chapter 13 Wolves. Fall came in a burst of glory that quickly faded to gray. The silence of the waning year lay like a haze over the lands of Pyotr Vladimirovich, while the icons multiplied under Father Constantine's hand. The men of the village labored over a new icon screen to hold them, St. Peter and St. Paul, the Virgin and the Christ. The people lingered about Constantine's room and gazed with awe at the finished icons, at their shapes and shining faces. Constantine was making a whole iconostasis, one image at a time.
"You owe your salvation to God," said Constantine. "Look on his face and be saved."
They had never seen anything like his Christ's great eyes, the pale flesh, and the long, thin hands. They looked and knelt and sometimes cried.
"What is a domovoy," they said, "but a tale for bad children? We are sorry, Batyushka. We repent."
Almost no one made offerings, even at the autumn equinox. The domovoy grew feeble and listless. The vazila grew thin and haggard and wild-eyed. The straw lay thick in his tangled beard. He stole rye and barley, stored for the horses. The horses themselves began stamping in their stalls and shying at breezes. Tempers in the village grew short.
"Well, it wasn't me, boy, and it wasn't a horse or a cat or a ghost," snarled Pyotr to the stable boy one bitter morning.
More barley had vanished in the night, and Pyotr, already on edge, was furious.
"I didn't see," cried the boy, sniffling. "I would never."
The air smarted, those mornings in November, and the earth seemed to ring underfoot, brittle with frost. Pyotr stood nose to nose with the youth and answered his denials with a clenched fist. There was a thud and a howl of pain.
"Never steal from me again," Pyotr said.
Vasya, just slipping through the stable door, frowned. Her father was never short-tempered. He never even beat Anna Ivanovna.
"What is happening to us?"
Vasya ducked out of sight and climbed into the hayloft. It took her a moment to locate the vazila, who was curled in on himself and half buried in straw. She shivered at the look in his eyes.
"Why are you eating the barley?" she asked, gathering her courage.
"Because there had been no offerings."
The vazila's eyes glowed disconcertingly black.
"Are you frightening the horses?"
"Their moods are mine and mine theirs."
"You are very angry then?" the girl whispered. "But my people do not mean it. They are only frightened. The priest will go away one day. Things will not always be so."
The vazila's eyes gleamed darkly, but Vasya thought she saw sorrow in them, as well as anger.
"I am hungry," he said.
Vasya felt a rush of sympathy. She had often been hungry.
"I can bring you bread," she said stoutly. "I am not frightened."
The vazila's eyelids flickered.
"I need little," he said. "Bread, apples."
Vasya tried not to think too hard about giving away part of her meals. Food was never plentiful after midwinter. Soon she would be grudging every crumb. But,
"I will bring them to you, I swear it," she said, looking earnestly into the demon's round brown eyes.
"My thanks," returned the vazila. "Keep your pledge, and I will leave the grain alone."
Vasya kept her pledge. It was never much, a withered apple, a gnawed crust, a drip of honey wine, carried on her fingers or in her mouth. But the vazila came for it eagerly, and when he ate,
the horses quieted. The days darkened and drew in. The snow fell as though to seal them up in whiteness. But the Vasila grew pink and content. The wintertime stable grew drowsy, as of old. Just as well. The season was a long one, and in January, the cold deepened until even Dunya could remember nothing like it. The remorseless winter dusk drove folk indoors. Pyotr had plenty of time to suffer the sight of his family's pinched faces. They huddled by the fire, chewing at bread and strips of dried meat, taking turns adding wood to the blaze. Even by night, they did not dare let it burn low. The older folk murmured that their firewood burned too fast, that it took 3 logs to keep the flames high, where before they had needed 1. Pyotr and Kolya decried that as nonsense, but their wood piles dwindled. Midwinter had come and gone, the days lengthened once more, but the cold only worsened. It killed sheep and rabbits and blackened the fingers of the unwary. Firewood they must have in such cold, come what may, and so as their stocks ran low, the people dared the silent forest under the glare of the winter sun. It was Vasya and Alyosha, out with a pony, a sledge, and short-hafted axes, who saw the paw prints in the snow.
"Ought we go after them, father?" Kolya asked that night. "Kill some, take their skins, and drive the rest away?"
He was mending a scythe, squinting in the oven light. His son Seryozha, stiff and silent, huddled against his mother. Vasya had given the enormous basket of sewing a dispirited look and seized her axe and a whetstone.
Alyosha shot her an amused look over the haft of his own axe. "See," said Father Constantine to Anna, "look around you. In God's grace is your deliverance."
Anna's eyes were fastened on his face. Her sewing lay forgotten on her lap. Pyotr wondered at his wife. She had never seemed so much at ease, though this was the bitterest winter in memory.
"I think not," said Pyotr, in answer to his son's question.
He was inspecting his boots. In winter, holes could cost a man a foot. He put one down near the fire and picked up the other.
"They are bigger than boar hounds, the wolves from the high north. It has been 20 years since they came so near."
Pyotr reached down and caressed Pios's gaunt head. The dog gave him a dispirited lick.
"That they do so now means they are desperate, that they would hunt children if they could, or slaughter sheep under our noses. The men together might take on a pack, but it is too cold for bows. It would be spear work, and not everyone would come back. No, we must look to our children and our livestock, and only go into the forest in daylight."
"We might set snares," put in Vasya,
over the scrape of her whetstone. Anna gave her a dark look.
"No," Pyotr said. "Wolves are not rabbits. They would smell you on the trap, and no one will risk the forest on such a small chance of gain."
"Yes, father," Vasya said meekly.
That night was deadly cold. They all huddled together on top of the oven, packed like salted fish, and covered with every blanket they possessed. Vasya slept badly. Her father snored, and Irina's small, sharp knees dug into her back. She tossed and turned, tried not to kick Alyosha, and at last, near midnight, fell into a shallow sleep. She dreamed of wolves howling, of winter stars swallowed up by warm clouds, of a man with red hair, a woman on horseback, and last, of a pale, heavy-jawed man with a look of hunger and malice, who leered and winked his single good eye. She woke up gasping in the bitter hour before dawn, and saw a figure cross the room, outlined by the light of the banked oven fire.
"It is nothing," she thought.
"A dream. The kitchen cat."
But then the figure paused. As though it sensed her regard, it turned a fraction. Vasya hardly dared to breathe. for she saw its face, a pale scrawl in the dim light. The eyes were the color of winter ice. She drew breath to speak or to scream, but then the figure was gone. Daylight was filtering in round the kitchen door, and from the village there came a wailing cry.
"It is Timofey," said Pyotr, naming a village boy.
Pyotr had risen before dawn to see to his stock. Now he came briskly through the door, stamping snow from his boots and brushing away the ice that had formed in his beard. He was hollow-eyed from cold and sleeplessness. He died in the night. The kitchen filled with exclamations. Vasya, half awake on the oven, remembered the figure that had passed in the darkness. Dunya said nothing at all, but went about her baking, lips set. Her glance flicked often and worriedly from Vasya to Irina. Winter was cruel to the young. At mid-morning, the women gathered in the bathhouse to wrap his wasted body. Vasya, spilling into the hut behind her stepmother, caught a glimpse of Timofey's face. He was glassy-eyed, the tears frozen on his thin cheeks. His mother clutched the stiffening body to her, whispering to him, ignoring her neighbors. Neither patience nor reason would draw the child from her, and when the women tugged him forcibly from her arms, she began to scream. The room dissolved into chaos. The mother flew at her neighbors, crying for her son. Most of the women had children themselves. They quailed at the look in her eyes. The mother clawed blindly, scrabbling. The room was too small. Vasya thrust Irina out of harm's way and seized the reaching arms. She was strong but slender, and the mother was wild with grief. Vasya clung and tried to speak.
"Let go of me, witch!" screamed the woman. "Let go!"
Vasya, disconcerted, loosened her grip, and an elbow caught her across the face. She saw stars, and her arms fell away. In that moment, Father Konstantin appeared in the doorway. His nose was red, his face as raw as anyone's, but he absorbed the scene in an instant, took two strides across the tiny hut, and caught the mother's groping fingers. The woman gave one desperate wrench and then stilled, trembling.
"He is gone, Yasna," Konstantin said, stern.
"No," she croaked. "I held him in my arms. All last night I held him as the fire burned low. He cannot, he will not leave if I hold him. Give him back to me."
"He belongs to God," said Konstantin, "as do we all."
"He is my son, my only son, mine."
"Be still," he said. "Sit down. This is unseemly.
Come, the women will lay him before the fire and heat water for washing." His deep voice was soft and even. Yasna allowed him to lead her to the oven and sank down beside it. All that morning, indeed, all that brief, dull winter day, Konstantin talked, and Yasna stared at him like a swimmer caught in a riptide, while the women stripped Timofey's body and washed it and wrapped it in cold linen. The priest was still there when Vasya came back from another bitter day searching for firewood. She saw him standing before the door of the bathhouse, gulping the cold air as though it were water.
"Would you like some mead, Batyushka?" she said.
Konstantin jerked in surprise. Vasya made no noise walking, and her gray furs mingled with the falling night. But after a pause he said,
"I would, Vasilisa Petrovna."
His beautiful voice was little more than a thread, the resonance gone. Gravely she handed him her little skin of honey wine. He gulped it with desperate eagerness. Wiping his mouth with the back of his hand, he handed the skin back to her, only to find her studying him, a furrow between her brows.
"Will you keep vigil tonight?" she asked.
"It is my place," he replied with a hint of hauteur. The question was impertinent. She saw his annoyance and smiled. He frowned.
I honor you for it, Batyushka, she said.
She turned toward the great house, melting into the shadows. Konstantin watched her go, lips pressed together. The taste of mead was heavy in his mouth. The priest kept that night's vigil by the body. His gaunt face was set, and his lips moved in prayer. Vasya, who had returned in the small hours to keep her own vigil, could not help but admire his steady purpose, though the air had never echoed so with sobs and prayers as it had since his coming. It was far too cold to linger over the boy's tiny grave, hacked with much labor out of the iron-hard earth. As soon as decency permitted, the people scattered back to their huts, leaving the poor thing alone in his icy cradle, with Father Konstantin hindmost, half-dragging the bereaved mother. People began cramming into fewer and fewer izby, with extended families sharing one oven to save firewood. But the wood disappeared so quickly, as though some ill wish made it burn. So they went into the woods, regardless of paw prints, the women goaded by the sight of Timofey's marble face and the dreadful look in his mother's eyes. It was inevitable that someone would not come back. Oleg's son, Daniil, was only bones when they found him, scattered widely over a stretch of trampled and bloody snow. His father brought the gnawed bone ends to Pyotr and, wordless, laid them before him. Pyotr looked down at them and said nothing.
Pyotr Vladimirovich, Oleg began, croaking, but Pyotr shook his head.
Bury your son, he said, his glance lingering on his own children. I shall summon the men tomorrow.
Alyosha spent the long night checking the haft of his boar spear and sharpening his hunting knife. A little color showed in his beardless cheeks. Vasya watched him work. Part of her itched to take up a spear herself, to go and brave dangers in the winter wood. The other part wanted to crack her brother over the head for his heedless excitement.
I will bring you a wolfskin, Vasya, Alyosha said, laying his weapons aside. Keep your wolfskin, Vasya retorted, if you can only promise to bring your own skin back without freezing your toes off.
Her brother grinned, his eyes glittering.
Worried, little sister?
The two sat apart from the mob near the oven, but Vasya still lowered her voice.
I don't like this. Do you think I want to have to chop your frozen toes off? Or your fingers? But there's no help for it, Vasochka, said Alyosha, putting down his boot. Wood we must have. Better to go out and fight than freeze to death in our houses.
Vasya pursed her lips, but made no answer. She thought suddenly of the Vasila, black-eyed with wrath. She thought of the crusts she brought him to quiet his anger.
Is there another who is angry? Such a one could only be in the wood, where the cold winds blew and the wolves howled. Don't even think it, Vasya, said the sensible voice in her skull. But Vasya glanced at her family.
She saw her father's grim face, her brother's suppressed excitement.
Well, I can but try. If Alyosha is hurt tomorrow, I will hate myself forever if I did not try.
Without pausing to think longer, Vasya went for her boots and winter cloak. No one bothered asking where she was going. The truth would not have occurred to anyone. Vasya climbed the palisade, hampered by her mittens. The stars were few and faint. The moon cast a blaze of light over the hard frozen snow. Vasya passed the eave of the wood, from moonlight into darkness. She walked briskly. It was dreadfully cold. The snow squeaked under her feet. Somewhere, a wolf howled. Vasya tried not to think of the yellow eyes. Her teeth would surely rattle out of her head from shivering. Suddenly, Vasya stumbled to a halt. She thought she'd heard a voice. Slowing her breath, she listened. No, only the wind. But what was that there? It looked like a great tree, one she half remembered. With an
odd sly memory that slid in and out of her mind. No, it was only a shadow cast by the moon. A bone-chilling wind played in the branches high above. Out of the hiss and clatter, Vasya suddenly thought she heard words. "Are you warm, child?" said the wind, half laughing. In fact, Vasya felt her bones would splinter like frost-killed branches, but she replied steadily, "Who are you? Are you sending the frost?" There was a very long silence. Vasya wondered if she had imagined the voice. Then it seemed she heard mockingly, "And why not? I, too, am angry." The voice seemed to throw echoes, so that the whole wood took up the cry. "That is no answer," retorted the girl. The sensible part of her pointed out that perhaps a little meekness was in order when dealing with half-heard voices in the dead of night. But the cold was making her sleepy. She fought it with every scrap of will and had none left over for meekness. "I bring the frost," said the voice. Suddenly it was curling icy, loving fingers about her face and throat. A cold touch like fingertips slipped beneath her clothes and wrapped round her heart. "Then will you stop?" Vasya whispered, fighting fear. Her heart beat as though against another's hand. "I speak for my people. They are afraid. They are sorry. Soon it will be as it always was. Our churches and our charity together, and no more fear or talk of demons." "It will be too late," said the wind, and the forest took it up. "Too late. Too late." Then, "Besides, it is not my frost you should fear, Dyavushka. It is the fires. Tell me, do your fires burn too fast?"
"It is only the cold that makes them burn so."
"Nay, it is the coming storm. The first sign is fear. The second is always fire. Your people are afraid, and now the fires burn."
"Turn the storm aside then, I beg you," said Vasya. "Here, I brought a gift."
She put a hand into her sleeve. It was nothing much, just a scrap of dry bread and a pinch of salt, but when she held it out, the wind died. In the silence, Vasya heard the wolf howl again, very near now, and answered in a chorus. But in the same instant, a white mare stepped out from between two trees, and Vasya forgot the wolves. The mare's long mane fell like icicles, and her snorting breath made a plume in the night. Vasya caught her breath.
"Oh, you are beautiful," she said,
and even she could hear the longing in her voice.
"Are you bringing the frost?"
Did the white mare have a rider? Vasya could not tell. One instant it seemed she did, and then the mare twitched her skin, and the shape on her back was only a trick of the light. The white horse put her small ears forward toward the bread and salt. Vasya held out her hand. She felt the horse's warm breath on her face and stared into her dark eye. Suddenly, she felt warmer. Even the wind felt warmer, where it twined around her face.
"I bring the frost," said the voice.
Vasya did not think it was the mare.
"It is my wrath and my warning, but you are brave, Dyavushka, and I relent, for the sake of an offering."
A small pause.
"But the fear is not mine, and neither are the fires. The storm is coming, and the frost will be as nothing beside it. Courage will save you. If your people are afraid, then they are lost."
"What storm?" whispered Vasya.
"Beware the turning seasons," she thought the wind sighed. "Beware." And the voice was gone.
But the wind remained. Harder and harder it blew, wordless, flinging clouds across the moon and the wind smelled blessedly of snow. The deep frost could not last while it snowed.
When Vasya stumbled back through the door of her own house, the flakes that covered her hood and caught in her eyelashes effectively silenced her family's clamor. Alyosha seized her in speechless delight, and Irina went laughing outside to catch a handful of the falling whiteness. That night, the cold indeed broke. It snowed for a week. When the snow finally stopped, it took them 3 more days to dig themselves out. By then, the wolves had taken advantage of the relative warmth to feast on stringy rabbits and move deeper into the forest. No one ever saw them again. Only Alyosha seemed disappointed. Dunya slept badly those late winter nights, and it was not only because of the cold and aching of her bones, nor yet her worry over Irina's cough or Vasya's pale face. "It is time," said the frost demon. There was no sledge in Dunya's dream this time, no sunshine or crisp winter air. She stood in a gloomy and muttering forest. It seemed that a greater shadow lurked somewhere in the dark, waiting. The winter demon's pale features were drawn fine as etching, his eyes drained of color. "It must be now," he said. "She is a woman, and stronger than even she knows. I can perhaps keep evil from you, but I must have that child."
"She is a child," protested Dunya.
"Demon," she thought. "Tempter. Liar. A child still. She teases me for honey cakes, even when she knows there are none. And she has grown so pale this winter, all eyes and bones. How can I give her up now?" The demon's face was cold. "My brother is waking. Every day his prison weakens. That child, all unknowing, has done what she can to protect you, with crusts and courage and the sight. But my brother laughs at such things. She must have the jewel."
The dark seemed to press closer, hissing. The frost demon spoke sharply, in words Dunya did not know. A bright wind filtered around the clearing, and the shadows drew back. The moon came out and set the snow to glowing.
"Please, Winter King," Dunya said humbly, clenching her hands together. "Another year, one more sun season. She will grow strong with rain and sunlight. I will not, I cannot give my girl to winter now."
Laughter suddenly boomed from the undergrowth. Old, slow laughter. Suddenly it seemed to Dunya that the moonlight shone through the frost demon, that he was nothing but a trick of light and shadow. But then he was a real man again, with weight and shape and form. His head was turned away, scanning the undergrowth. When he turned back to Dunya, his face was grim.
"You know her best," he said. "I cannot take her unready. She will die. Another year, then. Against my judgment."
Chapter 14. The Mouse and the Maiden. Anna Ivanovna suffered with the others that winter. Her hands swelled and stiffened. Her teeth ached. She dreamed of cheese and eggs and cresses, all the while eating sour cabbage and black bread and smoked fish. Irina, never strong, faded to a listless shadow of herself, and Anna, terrified for her child, found a strange kinship with Dunya in coaxing broths and honey down the child's throat and keeping her warm. But at least she saw no demons. The little bearded creature did not creep about the house. The twiggy brown beggar did not creep about the dvor. Anna saw only men and women, and endured only the ordinary troubles of a crowded house in a bad winter. And Father Constantine was there, a man like an angel, such as she had never imagined a man to be, with his shining voice and tender mouth and the blessed icons that took shape under his strong hands. She saw him every day that winter, when they were all cooped up indoors. It was meat and drink to her to bask in his presence, and she desired nothing more. Her mind was at ease. She could even bring herself to smile at her stepsons and endure Vasilisa. But when the snow came and the cold broke, Anna's peace was shattered. A gray noontide with little snow flurries out of a leaden sky found Anna running to find Konstantin in his cell.
"The demons are still here, Batyushka," she cried. "They came back. They were only hiding before. They are sly. They are liars. How have I sinned? Father, what must I do?"
She was weeping, shivering. Only that morning, the domovoy had crept, stubborn and smoldering, out of the oven and taken up Dunya's basket of mending. Konstantin did not answer at once. His fingers were blue and white where they gripped the brush. He had retreated to his room to paint. Anna had brought him soup. It sloshed in her trembling hands.
"Cabbage,"
Konstantin noted with disgust. He was mortally weary of cabbage. Anna put the bowl down beside him, but she did not go.
"Patience, Anna Ivanovna," the priest replied,
when it became clear she was waiting for him to speak. He did not turn around, nor slow his quick, dabbing brush strokes. It was weeks since he had painted. "It is an infestation of long-standing, fed by the straying of many. Only wait, and I will bring them back to God."
"Yes, Batyushka," Anna said. "But today I saw,"
he hissed between his teeth. "Anna Ivanovna, you will never be rid of devils if you creep around looking for them. What good Christian woman behaves so? You would do better to fear God and pass your time in prayer, much prayer."
He glanced pointedly toward the door. But Anna did not go.
"You had done wonders already. Do not think me ungrateful, Batyushka."
She swayed toward him, trembling. Her hand dropped onto his shoulder. Konstantin shot her an impatient glance. She jerked back as though burned, and a dull flush crept up her face.
"Give thanks to God, Anna Ivanovna," Konstantin said. "Leave me to my work."
She stood a moment, wordless, and then fled. Konstantin seized his soup and swallowed it at a gulp. He wiped his mouth and tried again to find the calm needful for painting. But the lady's words scratched at him.
"Demons, devils, how have I sinned?"
Konstantin's mind wandered. He had filled these people with the fear of God, and they were on the path to salvation. They needed him, loved and feared him in equal measure. Rightly, for he was God's messenger. They worshipped his icons. All that he could contrive with words and fierce looks, of obedience to God's will and spirit of humility, he had done. He felt the effect. And yet, unwillingly, Konstantin thought of Pyotr's second daughter. He had watched her that winter, her childish grace, her laughter, her careless impudence, the secret sadness that sometimes crossed her face. He remembered how once she had emerged out of the dusk, at home in the cold and the falling night. He himself had taken mead from her hand, not thinking beyond his gratitude that he might slake his thirst.
"She is not afraid," Konstantin thought dourly. "She does not fear God. She fears nothing."
He saw it in her silences, her fey glance, the long hours she spent in the forest. In any case, no good Christian maid ever had eyes like that, or walked with such grace in the dark. For her soul and for the souls of all in this desolate place, thought Konstantin, he must have her humility. She must see what she was and fear it. Save her, and he would save them all. Failing that, Konstantin paid no mind to his fingers. He painted in a haze while his mind worried away at the problem. At last, he swam back to consciousness, and his eyes took in what he had painted. Wild green eyes stared back at him that he had meant to make only a gentle blue. The woman's long veil could just as easily have been a curtain of red-black hair. She seemed to laugh at him, caught in the wood and forever free. Constantine shouted and flung the board away. It thudded to the floor, splattering paint. That spring was too wet and too cold. Irina, who loved flowers, wept, for the snowdrops never bloomed. The fields were plowed under torrents of unseasonable rain, and for weeks nothing would dry, indoors or out. Vasya, in desperation, tried putting their stockings in the oven with the fire pushed to one corner. She withdrew them considerably warmer, but no drier. Half the village was coughing, and she looked her brother over frowningly as he came to dress.
"As your experiments go, this one could have been worse," said Alyosha, eyeing his slightly charred stockings.
His eyes were red, his voice hoarse. He made a face as he pulled the warm, damp wool over his foot.
"Yes," said Vasya, drawing on her own stockings. "I could have cooked a lot."
She eyed him again.
"There will be something hot for dinner tonight. Don't die before the rain stops, little brother."
"No promises, little sister," said Alyosha darkly, coughing.
He straightened his hat and slipped outside. With the rain and the damp, Father Constantine took to making his brushes and grinding his stone in the winter kitchen. It was considerably warmer and somewhat drier than his room, though much noisier with dogs and children and the feeblest of their goats underfoot. Vasya regretted the change. He never once spoke to her, though he commended Irina and instructed Anna Ivanovna often enough. But even in the uproar, Vasya could feel his eyes on her, while she joked with Dunya, kneaded their poor thin bread, and plied her distaff. Vasya was always aware of the priest's steady stare.
"Better to tell me my fault to my face, Batyushka."
She hid in the stable whenever she could. Her forays into the crowded house meant rounds of unremitting work, while Anna screeched and prayed by turns. And always there was the priest's silence and his grave regard. Vasya never told anyone where she'd gone that bitter night in January. Afterward, she sometimes thought she had dreamed it, the voice on the wind and the white horse. With Constantine watching, she was careful to address no remarks to the domovoy. But the priest watched her all the same. It was, she thought, almost despairing. Simply a matter of time before she got herself into trouble and he pounced. But the days ran together, and the priest kept his silence. April came, and Vasya found herself in the horse pasture, stitching up Mish, Sasha's old horse, now a broodmare who had borne 7 foals. Though no longer young, the mare was still strong and sound, and her wise old eyes missed nothing. The most valuable horses, Mish among them, spent the winter in the stable and went out to pasture with the others as soon as the grass showed through the snow. Certain disagreements always arose in consequence, and Mish had a hoof-shaped gash on her flank. Vasya plied her needle more deftly in flesh than she did in cloth. The scarlet slash grew steadily smaller. The horse stood still, only shivering from time to time.
"Summer, summer, summer," sang Vasya.
The sun shone warm again, and the rain had stopped long enough to give the barley a chance. Measuring herself against the horse, Vasya found she had grown even taller over the winter.
"Well," she thought ruefully, "we can't all be small as Irina."
Tiny Irina was already hailed as a beauty. Vasya tried not to think of it. Mish broke into the girl's reverie.
"We would like to offer you a gift," she said.
She put down her head to nibble at the new grass. Vasya's hands faltered.
A gift?
You brought us bread this winter. We are in your debt.
Us? But the Vasila
is all of us together, replied the mayor. Something more as well, but mostly he is us.
Oh, said Vasya perplexed. Well, I thank you.
Best not be grateful for the grass until you've eaten it, the mayor said with a snort. Our gift is this. We wish to teach you to ride.
This time Vasya really did freeze, except the blood came rushing into her heart. She could ride on a fat gray pony she shared with Irina. But
truly? She whispered.
Yes, said the mayor, though it may prove a mixed blessing. Such a gift could drive you apart from your people.
My people, said Vasya, very low.
They wept before the icons while the Domovoy starved. I do not know them. They have changed, and I have not. Aloud, she said, I am not afraid. Good, said the mayor. We shall begin when the mud dries.
Vasya half forgot the mayor's promise in the weeks that followed. Spring meant weeks of numbing labor. And, at each day's close, Vasya ate the poor bread from the previous year's barley, with soft white cheese and tender new herbs, then flung herself onto the oven and slept like a child. But suddenly it was May, and the mud disappeared under new grass. Dandelions shone like stars amid the deep green. The horses threw long shadows, and the sickle moon stood alone in the sky. On the day that Vasya, sweating, scratched, and exhausted, stopped in the horse pasture on her way back from the barley field.
Come here, said Mish. Get on my back.
Vasya was almost too tired to reply. She gazed stupidly at the horse and said,
I've no saddle.
Mish snorted.
Nor will you. You must learn to manage without. I will carry you, but I am not your servant.
Vasya met the mayor's eye. A flicker of humor showed in the brown depths.
Does your leg not pain you? She asked, feebly, nodding at the half-healed gash on the mayor's flank.
No, Mish replied. Mount.
Vasya thought of her hot supper, of her stool by the oven. Then she gritted her teeth, backed up, ran, and flung herself belly down onto the mare's back. A bit of squirming, and Vasya settled herself uncomfortably just behind the hard withers. The mare's ears eased back at the scrabbling.
You will need practice.
Vasya could never remember where they went that day. They rode, of necessity, deep in the woods. But the riding was painful. That, Vasya always remembered. They jogged along until Vasya's back and legs trembled.
Be still, said the mayor. It is as if there are three of you instead of one.
Vasya tried, slipping this way and that. At last, exasperated, Mish pulled up sharply. Vasya rolled over the mare's shoulder and landed, blinking, on the loamy forest floor.
Get up, said the horse. Be more careful.
When they returned to the pasture, Vasya was filthy, bruised, and certain that walking was beyond her. She had also missed her supper and earned a scolding. But the next evening, she did it again, and again. It was not always with Mish. The horses took turns teaching her to ride. She could not go every day. In spring, she worked incessantly, they all did, to put the crops in the earth. But Vasya went often enough, and slowly her back and thighs and stomach began to hurt less. Finally, the day came when they did not hurt at all. And in the meantime, she learned to keep her balance, to vault to a horse's back, to spin and start and stop and leap, until she could no longer tell where the horse ended and she began. The sky seemed bigger that midsummer, clouds scudding across it like swans. The barley rippled green in the fields, though it was stunted
and Pyotr shook his head over it. Vasya, her basket over her arm, disappeared into the forest every day.